Jeff. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
No, I'm very excited for today's conversation. Where I want to start is you are building White Noise, and I've done some research around what you're creating, and it's just a fascinating thing to be working on. So that's where I'd love to start. Why are you doing that?
Yeah, great question. It's been a lot of work. No, in fairness, like it has been probably the most fun project I've worked on in a lot of years. Wow. You know, I think, you know, I came to Noster about 3 years ago. At the time, it was very broken, very hard to use, very hard to like understand what was going on. You know, I think even from those early days, like people knew that, you know, private messaging was a thing that we really needed to have. And we didn't, you know, we had a very broken version of it. And for a long time, it was just something that everybody said, you know, oh, somebody will fix this eventually. Somebody will fix this eventually. But no one was working on it really actively. And finally, one group of kind of, won't call them core devs, but like devs that were working on the protocol, you know, at a deep level said, okay, let's try and fix, you know, at least DMs to make it so that we're not sharing all the metadata around who's talking to who. And so they did do that. And that was NIP 17. And that actually was a big step up over the original, you know, private or DM messaging, NIP, but it still didn't have forward secrecy. It didn't have post-compromise security. It didn't work for groups. It was still a very, you know, it was kind of a solution to a very small point solution, you know, a point problem, which was we want to be able to DM somebody without everybody else knowing that I DM'd that person. But it didn't really solve the problem that most people think of when you think of a messenger, right? You think of a messenger, you think of groups, you think of rich chat with images and videos and whatever else in them. And you think of, at least when you think about end-to-end encryption, you think, okay, this conversation can go on into the future. Even if my like Noster key gets compromised, the attacker shouldn't get all of the conversations and all of the conversation history. And that, to be honest, is just a hard problem. Like it's a very hard computer problem. And so that was sort of, you know, the problem space I waded into. I'm not a cryptographer. Like I'm not a graybeard programmer that has, you know, been doing, messaging for years and years. I'm a pretty left curve web developer. Just no one was dealing with it. And so finally I was like, well, I guess I'll give it a try. Let's see what happens. Yeah. And turns out you can just do things. So yeah, here I am 2 years later with a, you know, nearly functioning messenger.
Cool. And so to spend some time talking around the problem, you mentioned a few things there that a lot of people won't understand, like even the idea of end-to-end encryption. So perhaps we start with that. Like,
sure.
What is the problem? Like, why can't I just send a message over the Noster DM? And how might that, you know, bite me in the ass in the future if I've sent something I shouldn't say? Or what can someone learn about me that I don't want them to know?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, it's a funny one. A month ago or so, Signal went down for a couple of hours because Cloudflare was offline. And it was funny to watch the response on Twitter and stuff, because a lot of people sort of assumed that because Signal was down, then it was somehow insecure, that somehow like people could read their messages and things. And really what was down was just delivery. You know, they couldn't get messages across the internet to your phone. So it wasn't about the encryption. It wasn't about the security of Signal at that point, but it really highlighted the fact for me that like people don't understand what end-to-end encryption means. And so a good way to think about this is, let's just take, you know, your phone and my phone as the two devices here. And this can obviously scale up to as many devices as you want, but, the idea here is that you have some sort of shared state that I also have on my phone. So we both have the same keys, and that means that we can, you know, put something in a box, you know, a message in a box. We lock the box with the key and then we send it with a courier. You know, let's go full analog here. We send the box with a courier. It arrives to you. You've got the same key. You can open the box and see the message, but the courier doesn't have the key, so he can't open the box. He has to transport the box, but he can't see what's inside of it. Right. That's kind of what end-to-end encryption is. The idea here is basically that somehow you and I agree to some shared state, and we agree on a method to change that state over time as we change things about the group, or we change, we send messages. There's just some pre-agreed thing that we are going to do in order to make sure that, you know, the keys are changing constantly and we're using fresh keys constantly, but we're doing so in a way that once we've got it all set up, we don't have to talk about it anymore. We just know how to do it. And it means that your messages are going to be encrypted on my device and sent to your device, and they stay fully encrypted the entire way. And they, you know, in the opposite direction, you encrypt your things on your device, they get to me, I decrypt them. Now, what that does mean, though, is that the copies of the unencrypted content live on our devices. So, you know, if you lose a phone, you've probably seen this with Signal or something else, you know, they've, most of them have good syncing and backup now, but, you know, certainly several years ago, if you lost your phone, all of your Signal messages are just gone. Like there's no way to get them back because they literally only lived on your phone. So that's sort of the trade-off inherent in end-to-end encryption, is that you make it very secure for the pathway to get messages between people. But you need to then be careful with the device, because how you store those messages locally means that, you know, if an attacker got your phone and got it unlocked, then they basically have all of your chats, all of your history, everything.
Yeah, well, and who knows what you might be sending someone, but the point is you send it to them, not to anyone else. And therefore, you don't want it to cost you something in the future that you never intended. And actually, the context of this that really was very helpful for me is I listened to you speaking with Tim on the Free Cities podcast, and the history of communication was just a cool thing to run through. So maybe we can spend a bit of time doing that. But the idea that, you know, previously you'd use a telephone and you'd go to a switchboard and that would then send you somewhere else. So how has this kind of communications technology built on top of itself to get to where we are today?
Yeah, it's amazing when you kind of go backwards and you look at both just general communications and like how we have improved speed and fidelity of communications over time, but also how you think about the way that people kept secrets and did, you know, encryption in the past. You know, if you go way far back, like people have, you know, used to write letters and they would seal them with wax so that if the letter arrived and the wax seal was broken, like, you know, the person knew that somebody in the middle had read it. You know, people very quickly figured out, you know, really basic ciphers where you could just rotate, you know, like the Caesar cipher, where you just rotate, you know, the letters of the alphabet by a certain number. And all that you need to know about the letter I'm going to send you is what number you need to turn the dial by to get back to the right letters. So that's a very simple one. It's like very brute forcible. Like somebody could just literally turn it once and like keep, you know, rewriting your letter until it makes sense. But over time, like people, you know, figured out better and better and better ways of doing this. Right. So yeah, I mean, like a good way to think about this, and, I don't remember exact context of what we were talking about with Tim at the time, but yeah, I mean, like we have always sort of had to trust people in the middle after a certain point, right? Like, you know, even when it was letters, we had to trust that somebody was going to deliver the thing for us and not look at it in the middle. So couriers, mail services, all sorts of things like that. Then we get to electronic age and we've got, you know, telegraphs where there's telegraph operators in the middle. There's an undersea cable. There's the guy who's actually listening to the Morse code on the other side and like translating it into a letter and handing it to you. So there's kind of always been people in the middle of our communications, right? And we've always had to trust them to some degree or another. I think once we got to, you know, the internet age, where almost all of our lives have been moving into the digital realm, this has become more and more critical, right? We cannot operate in society in full public transparency. At least that's my belief. I don't think it's possible to have total transparency of all citizens in society and that be a good thing. You know, we need to have whispers.
Is it necessary even, we need to, you know?
Yeah, it's totally not necessary, I don't think. But it's also just, it's detrimental in a lot of ways because, you know, you end up with these groupthink problems. You know, you end up censoring yourself because of what you think the social scenario around you demands of you. And so you can't have original thoughts. You can't have dissident thoughts. You can't say, I don't think this is a good idea, because those thoughts germinate first in your own mind. So, of course, you've got privacy in your own mind. At least I hope so, at least for now. but you know, like they're going in that direction too, but you know, you've got privacy in your own mind, but then where does that go next? It goes between you and maybe one close friend where you're like, hey, does this seem right to you? Like, let's talk about this some more. Yeah. And then it slowly expands to larger and larger groups. Right. And this is how like movements form and, you know, how governments topple and how we get an improvement in life overall on the planet, in my opinion, is that like, we have to challenge things. We have to push back against the norm or the, you know, the status quo. And so I think privacy is a really important part of that, because until you have some semblance of like security in those thoughts that are uncomfortable, you won't have them, or you'll shove them down and you won't think about them. So, you know, I think as we've become more and more digital, this sort of idea of how do we keep communications flowing over public infrastructure, you know, the internet backbones, all the fiber optic cables, where we know there's lots and lots of people in the middle. How do we do that without totally giving up our privacy and totally letting them see what those ideas are? And so there's kind of two parts of that, right? There's like keep the message confidential so they don't know what the message is, but also all the stuff around that, the metadata is really, really important. You know, who's talking to who, when, what are they, you know, might not know what they're talking about, but if there's like six or seven people that are always talking together on a Tuesday night and you triangulate a, you know, a few other things, you can probably tell a lot about what that conversation's about.
Yeah, interesting. I just always love the context for these things, because of course, you know, like a VC will be like, right, give me a pitch deck. I want to see the exact like succinct problem you're solving. It's like, well, here's a statement, but actually it's so much more than that, because this is a whole history of how humans have communicated and how it's evolved over time. And I wonder, like, because this is something I've only really recently started thinking through, is the difference between privacy and secrecy. And they're not the same thing. So how do you first of all think that through, Jeff? And we'll see where it takes us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Tim May. I hope I'm not butchering that. But like one of the original cypherpunks had this, you know, statement that like privacy is the ability to selectively reveal yourself to the outside world.
Yeah,
it's
I love that.
The ability where, you know, it's you having control over what you share with other people. Secrecy is sort of a sub branch of privacy in a lot of ways, because secrecy, all secrecy is saying is like, you're just keeping some things from other people, right? There can be a whole, like secrecy doesn't really have a moral judgment attached to it in any way. And I don't think privacy does either, but like, you know, secrecy, especially oftentimes you hear it as like, oh, they're being very secretive over there because they're doing something bad. Sort of the immediate assumption when you say somebody's being secretive is that they're doing something they shouldn't be doing, but that's not necessarily the case. They might be planning you a surprise birthday party, right? Obviously they want to keep that secret from you, but it's not anything that's like going to hurt you. So, you know, I think we have to be really careful that we don't let the media and, you know, especially politicians spin this, in a way that is just not what it means, and not actually how it functions in the world. You know, this is the same thing of like secrecy, privacy, they're tools. They're things that help us do things better, in our lives. Tools can be used for all sorts of purposes. And so, you know, you can have bad motives and use these tools badly, you know, to do harm to others, or you can use them well. And I don't think like, it's not the place of, society, in my opinion, to come down on the tools themselves. It's much more about like, okay, what were the actions that were taken with those tools?
Yeah. And that's the interesting one though, isn't it? It's like a thought is not an action, and a spoken word is not an action. Speaking with friends or speaking with others and actually utilizing the freedom of speech, in my view, is not an action. And so when people like in the UK where I grew up are now being jailed for things they've said online, like it's quite extraordinary what's going on in terms of the encroachment on the idea of even freedom of speech. It's like, hang on. So a tax-paying and law-abiding citizen sat in their home, commented on something online, and now there's a police officer in their house saying, that's not allowed. We're telling you you shouldn't be able to do that. And I don't even know, I'm not going to name a specific case, but what the hell's going on there? And I'll
exactly.
Then, you know, pump in with that, Jeff, like the very real lived experience of spending many, many hours on Twitter, you know, now X, people who had built themselves up followings around specific niches that they'd become passionate about. And Bitcoin's a really obvious one, but, you know, people more like in the general investing space that I was heavily involved in, openly admit they self-censor based on platform risk. You know, it's like, I'm not even going to bother commenting on that particular area of life because it's just too much of a risk for the other things that I use this thing for. It's like, whoa, just imagine what that means at scale when people aren't saying what they think.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And the scary part is, I would say this is like unprecedented, but it's not. Like, we've seen fascism. We saw this, you know, 100 years ago. This is not, you know, super surprising. There's a book called 1984 that pretty much spells this entire scenario out. And it's like, are we so dumb that we don't see this? Like, I don't understand how people, you know, are able to out of one side of their mouth say that they love democracy and freedom, but out of the other side of their mouth say those people should go to jail because I disagree with them. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I grew up in America and, you know, one of the things that I remember my parents like pointed it out to me, there was this like landmark Supreme Court case where a Jewish lawyer from the ACLU defended the Nazis' right to protest. There was a group of neo-Nazis in some small town that wanted to do a protest and the town shut them down and said, no, you can't, you know, because you're Nazis. And a Jewish ACLU lawyer took it all the way to the Supreme Court to defend their right to protest. And it was just like, that's America. You know, like that's freedom of speech. Like we might not like what they have to say. We might think they're terrible people for a lot of reasons and we might be right, but that doesn't preclude their right. And I think that's like, we just have lost that completely.
Yeah. When was that, Jeff?
I want to say it's like the 70s or 60s.
Yeah. Long. It feels like a long time ago. Because to me, that's long gone.
That's like impossible right now. Like, can you imagine that right now?
No, I can't. And even just in recent years, so I emigrated to Australia and was based in Melbourne for the COVID-19 stuff that kicked off. And it was an extraordinary experience as to like, we say this, anyone that questions this is not allowed. You know, and we ended up with a police officer on our doorstep telling my wife that she was owing the government money for fines for disobeying the chief health officer's rules. And it was extraordinary, man. It was really, and that's a story for another day. But if you questioned the government of Australia and their COVID-19 policies, they didn't like it. And it was turned into a police state, like center of Melbourne. I had friends who were arrested for trying to protest. I was at protests where the police just actively shut the whole thing down, arrested everyone, and said, this is not allowed. And it was done under the guise of health, because everyone was spreading COVID, apparently, by being in these, you know, groups.
There's always a very specific
health reason for the greater good to squash this set of dissidents. And actually, it was almost a radicalizing moment in a sense. I went to one protest where we saw the mainstream media crews there filming, and there were thousands of people, every age, every color you can imagine, at this thing saying, we don't agree with how this COVID situation is being managed. And that night on the TV newsreel, there were hundreds of protesters reported. I was like, I physically saw with my eyes thousands. And you're like, oh my God, they're lying. They're actively lying. How many other times has that happened in my life? And it just, you know, the whole process begins of like, why do I know what I know? Yeah. It's actually very scary. What's in a textbook? Well, hang on. Well, that's history, isn't it? Oh, but then very simple.
Yeah. Which history?
History.
Whose history?
Exactly, mate. You know, history is written by the victors. Yeah. Like, good point. I mean, I would write my history book if I just won.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a huge subject, this, isn't it? And so what is truth? You know, okay, something like Nostra comes along. Like, obviously, there's all this context. Mm-hmm. This is what motivates you, Jeff. So why do you think this is so exciting for you?
So this is an interesting, like, what is truth is actually a super fascinating question if you start to get down into it, because, and I'll try to not rabbit hole into the philosophy. I woke up in a slightly philosophical mood this morning.
Please, take it wherever you like.
I'll try not to do it, but... But I mean, like, you know, I think we as humans, like, we've never had perfect truth about, you know, how the world works, what's around us. Like, we, you know, we take in an enormous, our senses take in an absolutely enormous amount of data, right? And like, probably 99.9% of it gets thrown out immediately. Because your brain has evolved to be really, really good at filtering out which tiny, you know, fraction of information actually matters for the situation you're in currently, and then uses that information to sort of, you know, decide what to do in that moment, right? You see a rustle in the bushes, like there's a million other things happening around you, but like your brain is like rabbit or tiger, I should probably leave, you know, yes. because the rabbit case is maybe more likely, but fight if you run. Get it wrong, the tiger case is much worse, you know? So, you know, we have been tuned over millennia to operate in this way of filtering information at really high speed. So we don't have, there is no like truth per se. There is, you know, there's ground physical reality, but even that, like, you know, you start to get down into the quantum area. You're like, okay, how much of this do we actually understand versus not? You know, we have very good theories about a lot of it. But theories are just that, right? They're right until they're proven wrong because we've yes. learned something new. Mm. And that's kind of generally how I look at the world. It's like, you know, pure truth, perfect truth doesn't really exist. We get closer and closer to understanding how stuff works. But even then, like, I don't know that we're ever going to find a bottom of that well. And so Nostr kind of works like this, right? We have these relays in a very simple way. We don't assume that like the like counts or the follow counts are accurate because we're not even sure we're seeing the entire network. You know, it's a very large distributed network like humanity. There are pools of data all over the place, which are all these different relays. I connect to some subset of those. Maybe those relays connect to other relays and pull data in, maybe not. But what I see is sort of my curation of the world. You know, I follow certain people, I interact with certain things, I use certain, you know, clients, certain applications. That helps to shape what I get to see. If I go to Japan and connect to all the Japanese relays, I see a totally different version of Nostr. Like, I mean, and this is like actually real. You go to Japan, they have all their own relays that are geo-flagged or geo-blocked. So like you can only use them in Japan. And when you connect to them, it's all just Japanese and it's a totally right. different set of Nostr users that you don't see that. Anywhere else.
Cool.
Yeah, it's cool. Like it's really cool. And that's what humans are. Like that's literally how we have evolved over time. Like
we have smaller nature, groups. That,
yeah, it's way closer to nature. And once you break the idea in your head that like there is a global feed that's the accurate truth of everything, then you start to go, oh, okay, well, if that's not the way it really is, then, you know, how should I be using this and what should I be using it for? And, you know, all those things start to change. So I think that's part of what got me really excited was that when I looked at Nostr at the beginning, it was like, this is a thing to replace, you know, Twitter X, you know, social media. But when I looked at it, I was like, this isn't social media. This is the internet over again. Like this is the entire internet. We can rebuild pretty much anything we want on this with two major distinctions. One, our identities are now cryptographically guaranteed, which the early internet didn't have. You know, we have email and password login across hundreds of sites because we didn't have a canonical thing that we could hang on to and say, this is me. And we didn't have base layer money on the internet. And that's why we ended up with credit card payments and SaaS providers and advertising driven models and yeah, Stripe, like all of that stuff came out of the fact that there was no way to do micropayments on the internet, right? Like from the very earliest HTTP spec, there was an error code, like, you know, the error code 404, when you don't find a page, it says 404, yes. page not found. Code 402 means payment required. So it was in the very beginning of the internet, like they were saying like, okay, you're going to have to pay for these web pages. But then it just never happened because they couldn't really figure out how to do small enough transactions at the time. So it just... it became a non-thing.
Wow. And it's a funny process, isn't it? I really love the phrase of building on the shoulders of giants. And so you actually couldn't have Nostr without Bitcoin. Like if Nostr was something you tried to build before Bitcoin arrived, then you'd be creating your own token, maybe. I don't know how it would work, but it didn't. Is the point. So you needed these other things to happen first before it's like, okay, well, what would actually a decentralized communications protocol look like that solves some of the problems that we see with the legacy internet experience, which has become basically four or five companies that people jump between private real estate to use for their, you know, very, very good tools, but at a cost that is hidden. And when I say hidden, maybe that's not the right word. At a cost that is disguised. It's a better way of saying like, use my tool. It's free. You get all this fun, all this education, all of this information, and it's amazing. But
free.
On the back end, it's stealing from you, essentially. Very cool. Because you probably had a number of different directions you could have gone in with your career. Quote-unquote career. I don't really like that word these days. But like, was there a specific moment or... Like, what was it that really caught your attention about Nostra in the first place? You're like, oh, I've got to learn more about this.
Yeah. So I spent kind of, I guess, almost 15 years working in startups before Nostra. And these were all traditional tech startups, you know, starting in like, you know, the late 2000s. And, you know, so I basically had a front row seat to see how the whole VC tech, you know, model took over everything, you know, from the very beginning, the earliest SaaS folks, like all that stuff. And it was both amazing, like super fun. Like I got to work at some really amazing companies, worked with some of the smartest people I've ever worked with. But really towards the end, I did start to get this, you know, feeling of like, this isn't doing what we hoped it was going to do. Like this is somehow morphed into something really not good. You know, like the early internet felt just pure opportunity, you know, like it's so cool. Like all these chat rooms, all these bulletin boards, like games being passed around, people modding everything, you know, just everything was sort of open and, it was just like wild-eyed optimism everywhere. And yeah, there was a ton of mess in there as well. Like people were selling credit cards. I'm sure there was like some really nefarious stuff going on, like whatever. That's humans. Like we are messy creatures. That's just how it works. And I think, you know, I had sort of been, you know, towards the end of the startup journey, I was kind of going, okay, I'm either going to work in Bitcoin or I'm, you know, going to do my own company. And I ended up doing my own company for a very short period. We raised a pre-seed round and then, you know, we're looking to raise our seed right as the bottom fell out of the market in early 2022. And I remember just talking to the investors and they were like, you did everything right. You just got the timing wrong. So, you know, see, like call us on the next one. And so I remember just kind of being like, oh, okay, like, it's kind of strange. I just burned a load of your money and that's, you seem totally fine with this. And at that point, I was kind of going, what am I going to do next? And I was kind of looking at Bitcoin companies and then I bumped into Nostra. And when I saw it, it was just, I was kind of like in disbelief for a week or two. I was just like, this can't be what I think it is.
Cool.
And I reached out. Yeah. I don't know if you know,
must Pablo. Learn more.
So I don't know if you know before, Pablo. He was like, another Nostra dev. And I reached out to him. You know, we didn't know each other. We had a couple things in common. So I just kind of pinged him one day and was like, hey, perfect. You want to jump on a call and talk about this Nostra thing? And what was supposed to be like a half an hour call went for like several hours. We were of us just like yelling at each other at full speed, like, la, 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 la. So
cool.
At that point I was like, okay, this seems like it's a thing. And it's incredibly early. You got to like really squint to see it. But, I think there's going to be some like really fun stuff that comes out of this. And so at that point it was just like, okay, I'll give it 6 months. I'll just like work on it full time 6 months, see what we can build. And we'll see where we go. And towards the end of that 6 months, that was about the time OpenSats started to spin up and had, you know, started doing Nostra grants. And so I was able to get a grant and kind of keep the ball rolling for a little while longer and, you know, basically just keep going till now.
And so, I've also done some angel investing and things in the past and looked very closely at startups and tried to start some of my own and none of them worked. I'm always interested in like, how do you make money out of something? So is White Noise a company or it's actually just a project that you've taken funding for as a like open source grant process? And yeah. I'm just intrigued as to like, because it's just so, so different.
Yes.
And I love that. Like, hang on, what does it mean if the people building this from the bottom are motivated in a different way? Because the internet would be different if it wasn't so ad driven.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the problems, right? Is the main business models become monetize eyeballs somehow. Mm-hmm. Even Gmail's being gamified. Like, it's out of control. It's like, what would it look like if that wasn't the incentive structure at the bottom?
Yeah.
And I think maybe like Nostra is that.
For customers.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question. I mean, like, you know, White Noise is not a company, not a for-profit company. I had to think about that for a little while at the beginning. Was like, you know, what's the format here? To me, I took the path I did mostly because, to me, this is like public infrastructure for humanity to thrive. You know, we need a distributed way of talking to each other safely, privately. And I don't want that, you know, tainted by any other incentive. Now that's not to say that the thing is not going to cost money and is not going to, you know, we're not going to be, you know, pushing really hard to try to make it work. I think that it requires a different set of incentives. So it is, you know, we've set up a 501c3 nonprofit. We're still waiting on some of the, you know, details there, but, you know, the idea is that similar to the Signal Foundation, you know, this will remain free in perpetuity. We will definitely have things where people can donate to us in the app. We will definitely, you know, there's like a version of the world in the future. I wouldn't say definitely, but there's a version of the world in the future where maybe we run certain like add-on services that people want to pay for and they can. We will definitely go to major donors and be looking for money for this thing, for, you know, covering it into the future. One cool thing though I'll mention is that, you know, Signal, which, you know, I think Signal's amazing. Like, it's a great product. I do actually trust that they're, you know, very secure. I mean, I've looked at all the papers, all the, you know, all the open source stuff that they do. I do actually think they're incredibly secure, and they go to extreme lengths to like blind themselves and their servers from knowing who's talking to who and what they're talking about. And, you know, they tick all the boxes and, you know, do all the things right. But even Signal, like, they have to run a lot of servers. They pay $50 million a year in servers to run the Signal service. And so if that dried up, if they didn't have that money 1 year, or they, you know, got into legal trouble because somebody didn't like something that, you know, Meredith Whitaker, the CEO, said, then Signal could just disappear for all of us. And that's a centralization risk. The amazing thing about white noise is we don't have to run any servers, right? We have Nostr relays, and that's it. And you can choose whichever Nostr relays you want. And so there will never be a, you know, super high ticket server bill for us, the way that Signal is, because of what we've built on top of. Because we don't have, you know, user accounts with phone numbers and things like that, we won't be a honeypot for trying to get to people's data. So I think that's kind of a really encouraging thing, is like, for a very small fraction of the money that, you know, it costs to run Signal, we could potentially run a service that's even better and more resilient.
Wow. Gosh, it's cool. It really gets me thinking about so many different angles, but it's this, oh, how do I even describe this? Coming across Bitcoin is such a revolutionary process, and it happens over almost many years. But one of the ways that I've previously described, like taking a meaningful position in Bitcoin, and with an investment lens, like, what's your allocation and your portfolio and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, well, this is digital property rights that aren't previously accessible. And so all of your TradFi investment portfolio, it carries some kind of counterparty risk that most people won't tell you, right? Your stock portfolio, well, you've actually bought it through some kind of discretionary manager, and you've got to trust all of them to give you your money when you ask for it. And Bitcoin is just this whole different beast, right? It's actually money. It's a savings tool. You can have it in self-custody. And it's like a foundation upon which to build that wasn't previously possible. And like, you hear Saylor talking about the difference between using wood and steel to build things. Yeah. It's such a cool concept. How you just described Nostr and the ability to use relays instead of some kind of centralized server and Signal is kind of similar, right? You're actually using an entirely different architecture to build something that's more resilient. And like, I would pay for that. Like, in the same way that I've previously played around with paying for relays, like, why wouldn't I pay for a good DM service? Like, I would. I'm sitting here right now knowing that. I'm also a paying subscriber for, I recently signed up to Albi and their node for Lightning channels. Yeah. Like, that kind of stuff. Really cool. And you start like, I would actually pay for all of these things to know that they're mine. Unlike, for example, you know, a Google Workspace that I still pay for. I'm like, oh, I really would like to not use Google if I didn't have to. But like, I like Google Docs, and suddenly you're doing stuff and you're using
it's
that.
Good.
Like,
I mean, they're really good products.
Google Calendar.
You can throw 100,000 like, engineers at problems like that for many, many years. You come out with amazing products. Yeah. Like, it's, the infinite money printer does have its benefits for Google, for sure.
Absolutely.
And that's a hard one for us, right?
You're like, building on something totally different, aren't you?
Yeah. Totally different. I mean, and it's a real hard one. You see when people come in, like devs come into Nostr, and like, they still have this sort of client server, classical client server architecture in their mind. And it's really hard for them to sort of break from this thing of like, oh, I ask the server for data and it gives me data, and then I display the data. You know, it's like, no, that's not how it works. I mean, yes, you're going to ask a server, the relay, for data, but it's going to stream it into you, and you're never sure it's going to be all right. You're going to have to validate it as it comes in. You're going to have to, you know, decide what you're going to do with it. And it's funny, like, you know, I think simply just those two things I mentioned before, which is your identity is portable and is, you know, tied to a cryptographic key, which means that all the content that you put out has to be signed to be valid. So it's untamperable. You know, no one can tamper with the events that you have put out in the world. You know, like, it's actually trivial for some random, you know, AWOL ex employee to like get into the database and like start tweeting random crap from Donald Trump's account. You know, like, they could do that. That's a thing. And there's nothing that any of us in the world would be able to look at that and be like, is that real or fake? You know what I mean? Like, what just happened here?
Fake news.
But you can't tell. There's no way to tell. Like, literally no way to tell. Yeah, you wouldn't know. They would just delete them later and they'd be like, oops, sorry. You know, we had a crazy, crazy like guy went mental. In Nostr world, literally, you know for a fact. Like, if somebody is tweeting from, you know, or sending notes from, you know, Trump's account or whatever, if it's signed with the right signature, you know that that person has control, at least, of Donald Trump's keys. You know, that's, you know, it's a fact. It's a mathematical fact. And so, you know, that with an identity that's portable, you can move all of your data to different apps. The apps themselves are basically commodity. You know, like, very quickly, I was like, this is going to collapse to just be a total, you know, competitive landscape built on nothing but brand and like user experience. Because if you can't deliver the best user experience or have a, you know, much better brand or solve the problem 10x better, then like, no one's going to use your stuff. Yeah, because they can literally just pick up and move over to another product instantaneously. So there's like zero lock-in in Nostr. And again, that idea of like decentralized relays means that your data is like everywhere and always and kind of backed up. You like let information do what information does, which is, you know, spread and copy itself.
And so, Jeff, this is something that's interesting in terms of the, like, is there venture backable opportunities within Nostr? And, you know, you just described very well the, okay, we'll dive into that. The context I was going to give is like the, in the Bitcoin market, it's like, who's actually making money and what is actually a VC backable kind of concept remains to be seen. So money's been thrown around, not all that much, frankly, as Bitcoin only, and some businesses are coming through slowly but surely. But like, for example, like the exchange market, very, very obvious. The people that were like, Bitcoin as an exchange business is really shit. And it's only going one way, which is that margin's getting smaller and smaller and smaller just because so many ways of buying Bitcoin. Well, let's list a whole lot of altcoins and get people doing, you know, degen trading casino stuff because that's how we're going to make some money as an exchange business.
Yeah, high volume.
You see very clearly why they ended up going in those directions as businesses.
Right.
With Nostr, what you just described is interesting to me. So the idea that like if your brand isn't brilliant or if your UX isn't brilliant, people will go elsewhere. Well, yeah, where is the business there in that sense? So you see some opportunities. I'd be intrigued to see like, you know, what might work.
Yeah, I mean, let's look at Bitcoin very quickly and I'll do a quick example and then we'll step into Nostr. So like my friend Rob's company, AnchorWatch, you know, they do insurance.
Cool.
Insurance is a boring business, right? Yeah. So, but like, if you think about it, that's a very valuable service for someone, right? Like they want to have control over their keys. They don't want to be leaving everything with Coinbase, but you know, it represents a very, you know, large part of their wealth. And so they recognize that like, hey, I should probably insure this the way I insure my house or the way I insure, you know, my boat, whatever it is. And so paying for insurance is a service that a company offers and that a customer who wants that service will pay for. Like it's just a very straightforward business to customer transaction. There's no like nefarious things in the middle. Like in the advert model, like the whole thing is predicated on the fact that there's nine people in the middle of the transaction and you are not one of them. You know what I mean? Like Google is selling to a big stack of players over on one side that you have no idea that even exists. And to my mind, this is also why, you know, the whole healthcare system in America is totally fucked. People are like, oh, well, look at America, public health, you know, private healthcare doesn't work. And I'm like, no, this is not what we have over in America. In America, we've got a health system where you're forced and your employer is forced to pay for this health insurance thing. But there's like nine people in a big stack off to one side. It's like the buyer and then the hospital and then the, you know, aggregator of the hospitals. And then like, so there's all these layers of obfuscation where the service between the person providing the service and the person, you know, getting the service has been completely erased. And so how can you provide a good service in that scenario? So, you know, in Rob's case, Rob sells insurance, people buy insurance, problem done. You know, like they get value, yeah, nice. He gets value. That's the end.
Yeah.
I think in a similar way, there will be plenty of things in Nostr world like that, right? So there will be people that go way deep on, you know, having really high availability relays that do a bunch of moderation and like cleanup and spam control. And like they spend a lot of time on figuring out how to give you just high quality stuff that's not trash. And that'll be a service that people will pay for sure. You know, you'll be like, I don't want to see all that garbage. Like, I want to make sure that like I've got parental controlled relays for my kids. Like, you'll pay for that. And so, you know, it'll be the same as I guess any, you know, business. And unfortunately, like the internet has sort of trained most people to think of like everything on the internet should be free. Simply because, like you said before, you know, what they're paying has been sort of hidden from them. But I think we're sort of starting to recognize that more as a culture. And I think we're starting to lean back in the other direction of, hey, if I want something good, I should probably be willing to pay something for it. And there will be lots of businesses that do lots of different parts of that stack in really good ways, you know?
Yeah, very cool. And in that sense, it requires you just to kind of take a breath and think about what works in the analog world and what's been missed by the current iteration of the internet that might end up in Nostrland. And more often than not, opportunities come from your own personal experiences, don't they? You're like, oh, well, I'd probably pay for that. Why doesn't that exist? And every day there is good marketing for Nostr. You know, there's just so much censorship going on. Like even, is it this week here in Australia, there's all sorts of laws coming in around digital identity and having to access the internet via a driving license.
Age verification for everything.
Yeah. And 16-year-olds have been banned from social media, and it's wild, right? So the police have arrived on the internet in a major way.
Yeah.
And what was so interesting, again, when I looked into this a month or two ago, it's very aggressive how companies are being told they have to behave. And if a user misbehaves, then the penalty is thousands and thousands of dollars on the company.
Right.
So all of these tool providers, they're going to do what the government's telling them to do. Otherwise, it's going to bankrupt them, basically. So it'd be very interesting to see what comes out of that. But Nostr benefits. It must. Like, how do people not look at that and go, okay, do you know what? I'm not having someone tell me what I can and can't say online, and I'm not going to be sharing all of my private details just to log in and do a search for something. Fuck that. I'm going in a different direction.
Yeah.
And someone like something like White Noise is a key part of that, isn't it? As I think about it, because like, of course, you need to be able to send people messages without everyone reading them.
Right, right. Very important. I guess like one thing I thought of just there is, you know, maybe I shouldn't have been so quick to say yes to your like VC question. I think you know, a lot of what people think of as VC may not quite exist for all that much longer. I think we've just gone through a period where, I mean, VC has sort of collapsed back a little bit. It's going mental with AI at the moment, but I think it got really way out over its skis there for a while because, you know, the VC model wins big when there's this, you know, natural monopoly effect with the service that they are, you know, backing, right? Like when you back Google and they win completely on, you know, the online search, it means they've got this like one in a million unique opportunity where, you know, it's never going to happen again. And so I don't know that we're going to get exactly that scenario with VC backing in Bitcoin or in Nostr. I think it might go back to what VC was before, which is, hey, you have a capital intensive setup. You need capital in order to get this business up and running. And then you'll have a very defensible position that we can, you know, take off of going forward, you know? So back to AnchorWatch, like they had to set up all the relationships with the banking partners and the insurance providers and the reinsurance people, and they had to get certified for all sorts of stuff. And, you know, it's a long, arduous process. They also had some like tech knowledge that I think is, you know, deeper than any other, you know, player in the market. So like they knew the thing inside out and they had all the proper stuff backing them. So, you know, a VC in some ways should be looking at that and going, okay, this is something where us having money can give these guys the head start to really solidify a position. But I don't think it's going to necessarily be the 10,000x returns of we've taken the entire internet. You know, we've taken all of humanity like Facebook or Google.
yeah.
you know, I hope that's not the case. Yeah.
So do I, actually. And because it's, well, it's a couple of things, isn't it? And I love this subject, by the way. It's like, how do we incentivize innovation? How do we profit from risk reward? Like, there are incredible people out there that are doing difficult things and trying stuff that no one else is trying to potentially benefit many, many more people than initial traction might kind of suggest. It's like, that's still an interesting game to me. It's like, well, someone needs money to build this thing. This thing could be a lot more valuable than it is right now. And you know, I'm recently reading a book about some entrepreneurs in America that were building railroads in the 1800s. And this guy, he just knew that connecting together these two areas, like basically between the US and Canadian borders around the Great Lakes, it was a great fucking idea because he could just see farmland for just miles and miles and miles, but no one had done it yet. So he was already thinking about how valuable this place was going to be, but no one had built it.
Right.
And his position in the business he built, he wasn't the wealthiest, he wasn't the most well-connected, but he's the guy that knew the shit on the ground inside out, and they needed him. And you think, isn't that interesting? That's almost 200 years ago. But like, what's the equivalent today? Where it's like, well, I think most people that are along Bitcoin in a major way, having conversations like this, re-engineered their life around sound money, we're already like well along the path to like, okay, fiat's long gone for us as a building technology.
Yeah.
And so this concept of putting money into a VC fund that's able to get you outrageous returns when the money's so cheap, it doesn't make sense in the world we're moving into. But real businesses will still exist. And so if you see opportunities for those businesses, then investing in some of them early might well be very profitable. But of course, you've got the Bitcoin hurdle rate next to that, where it's like, well,
of course,
maybe just sit on the king itself and, you know, everything will be okay. So I don't know. It's the word VC in some ways got a bit nasty, hasn't it, as to what it represents. But like, people are still going to bet on some early ideas.
Right. You hit it on the head though. Like when the money was cheaper than free, you know what I mean? Like the interest rates in Europe were negative for a while there. Like everybody forgets. That's like crazy, we were in the weirdest period ever with ZERP. You know, money was cheaper than free. And you know, that caused a lot of misallocation of capital. And like, that's just exactly what it was. Like it clearly was that situation. So I think you're totally right. Like bring back sound money, make the hurdle rate high. People that have capital will only deploy capital when it's a really good idea, you know? And so those really good ideas will get built and a lot of the trash won't. And like, yeah, okay. Some really, you know, some probably good ideas also won't get built. But that's also fine. You know, like that's just how it works. So yeah, I mean, like I look at Nostr and I think we're so unbelievably early with it. You know, people don't understand keys. They don't understand, you know, any of the basic cryptography things and why that matters. I think, you know, Bitcoin's still really early, even though it's quite a bit older than Nostr. So the idea of having like Bitcoin payments for a lot of people, especially in the West, that makes no sense whatsoever. They're like, yeah, but I got Venmo. I got Cash App. Why do I care? You know, when you go to Africa, people get it immediately. You're like, this is Nostr. This is how it works. You get paid Bitcoin for shitposting. And they're like, what? Like it blows their minds. And they're like, show me now.
Yeah, for what? Listening,
you know,
to
like they're set up instantaneously. Yeah, totally. Like they are in it immediately. Cause they're also the people that are getting cut off from the internet, cut off from the services. Like their voice is getting silenced in the places they are. You know, and money doesn't work in a lot of these places, you know, like the money is garbage. Like, you know, how many people in the West know about the, you know, CFA franc, you know, the central African franc, which is, it's a colonial holdover where all these nations still have to use money made up by the French and can't use it anywhere else in the world. They can't even use it in their neighboring countries. They have to translate it from like the one CFA franc to the other CFA franc and get, you know, their eyes ripped out in the process.
It's criminal, isn't it? It's
super criminal. Yeah, it's so criminal. But like you show them Nostr and Bitcoin,
but
and
we're
they're
the good guys.
Bro, I got it. This is,
Like, yeah, it's so
we
interesting.
Know what
we're doing
now. Like, this makes total sense.
Yeah. And to use some more startup analogy, like product market fit for Bitcoin is at the fringes of the financial services system where people are like, this works and everything else doesn't. So I'm going to use it. Yeah. I made a previous podcast actually, Jeff, called Bitcoin with Jake from 2022 for 12 months, which is a big part of my deep dive before, or as I made the biggest allocation of the whole last 5 years into Bitcoin from traditional assets. And the thing that really got me over the edge in terms of confidence and in terms of adoption, and just like this thing is real, was stories of people from Venezuela or from Kenya or from Guatemala, wherever they were from. And I was able to get them on a video call and ask them, like, so where did you grow up? What was it like? Why do you use Bitcoin? And they're like, boom, 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 boom. And you're like, wow, that's massive. Well, of course, this is a big deal. And I had to unlearn a lot of stuff through that, but willingly did. And here I am today. Jeff, I'm aware of time. So I just want to sneak in one question. So is Max working on White Noise with you? Or have you worked with him recently?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So Max and I
wasn't sure of that.
Yeah. So when I started kind of looking into this, I've been, friends with Max, and we've talked about lots of different projects and things over the years. And I remember we were at a conference. We were actually at Cheat Code in Bedford 2 years ago. And I remember sitting down with him and being like, I think I'm going to look into this messaging stuff. And he was like, oh yeah. Max loves that whole angle of stuff, all the cryptography, everything. So he was immediately like, all right, tell me more. And Max is like, not a coder. Like he is not a software engineer. He's very technically minded. And I think he understands the concepts better than a lot of, people that are writing code. So he's a great like rubber duck to like talk through stuff with, even like quite technical things. So I remember we just sort of like sat there for, a couple hours one afternoon, and we're just like going through some of the old protocols and like, okay, this is the way that this thing, OTR off the record worked. Like, and what did it like, what, why did it work like that? Okay. This is how the original signal protocol worked, and this is how they made it work for groups. And, we kind of went through all these things, and then just, I went back home, and, Max went along, and we just would do kind of a phone call or something every week for a while. And it'd be like, okay, I've gotten this next section. Like, what do you think about this? And like, how do you think about, how are we going to protect this bit of the metadata? And so it was just a lot of back and forth like that for quite a while until, I basically had the thing cracked in a sense of, okay, I'm using this protocol MLS for the key agreement and key sharing, which is, very efficient at large scale for groups. And we're applying that over Nostr relays and Nostr identity like this. And MLS is really cool because it doesn't care about, it doesn't care about the delivery, and it doesn't care about the identity system. They basically say that at the very beginning of the doc. They're like, you got to bring your own identity and you got to bring your own delivery. And I was like, well, what is Nostr really good at?
Cool.
Identity and delivery. I was like, perfect. This is great. But it was a bit of a trick to like figure out how to mash it in there and make it so that you weren't, giving away data and metadata, especially about the conversation and who was in it. So once we'd kind of worked out all those, a lot of those details, it was like, okay, this is a thing. Like, this is going to be a thing. We're going to build the thing. And at that point we just were like, okay, yeah, we're going to do the thing, right? Okay. We're going to do the thing.
Cool.
It's been Max and I sort of, driving it a lot of ways. And I think it's great because, he compliments me on so many things and, takes stuff off of my plate that I don't want to deal with. And I take, the code stuff off that, he can't deal with. And so it's been a great partnership.
Awesome. Well, shout out to Max. I had the pleasure of meeting him at the Indonesia Bitcoin conference a couple of years ago now. He's also been on the podcast in the past. And just a really great thinker. Like, you can just get him talking about these subjects. And he's able to eloquently explain something better than anyone else I've ever heard explain something on some areas where I'll ask him. You're like, fuck yeah, that was good, Max. How do you do that?
It's quite amazing.
Well, Jeff, listen, so we're coming up to the hour, and I said we'd finish then. So I really, really appreciate your time talking this evening. So thank you. I'd like to just leave it with one last thing, which is, so what are you most excited for over the next kind of 12 months?
Excited in a slightly anxious way, maybe, in the sense that, I do kind of feel like we're in a bit of a race at the moment. They are trying hard to close the doors on us. All of the age verification stuff, all of the, like the samurai stuff is really worrying in the sense that, hey, you built an open source tool and now we're going to send you to jail for how other people used it.
That's wild, isn't it?
All that stuff is signs of more bad stuff to come. I still think we're going in the wrong direction. And it's sort of a race to see like who's going to get, enough momentum there fast enough. I'm not under any illusion that like we're going to convert, 8 billion people to use Nostr in the next few years. But it needs to be solid enough and widespread enough that it is unstoppable, right? Like, you know, for the first few years, Bitcoin was definitely very stoppable. Like any major state actor could have come in and just crushed it. But they all laughed at it and thought it was nothing, right? Until it got to this point where it was like, actually, the resources required to turn this off are basically, you know, beyond the reach of anyone now. And I don't think we're there with Nostr, and I don't think we're there with a lot of the privacy tech and a lot of the kind of freedom tech that's out there. And so I think, you know, next 12 months is for sure, like, you know, it's go time. We need tools on top of Bitcoin to make it easier and faster. We need tools on top of Nostr to make it more private, more secure. We need to like make this not less of a toy and more of like, these are, you know, life and death tools for actual real people in the world. And for those people, you know, like you said before, that product market fit might be small, that market might be small right now, but I think if we get it to some critical mass, then it becomes unstoppable and we're in a much better position.
And it has the raw ingredients to do that, but it's that process of being okay with the fact that you happen to know this a lot earlier than anyone else. Like, just because you've pieced all the bits together and you're early, doesn't mean you're wrong. Just the world doesn't look like how you think it will look. And it's really hard to be in that place because you're like, hang on, are we sure that this is real, isn't it? What the hell's going on here?
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for your time. It's been really cool to learn from you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.